idea that the fugue, which even in its own time was thought to be antiquated and thought to be dry, that the mathematics of the fugue, if you like, can create true beauty, and a beauty that was unknown even by the sort of more modern styles that were surrounding Bach. And I think that's really the perfect dialectic, if you like, between the past and the future. And Bach does this so effortlessly. If you like, Bach is the original cool.
What is it that Bach does with those ideas that elevates them to such an iconic piece of music, then?
Well, I think, you know, by this point, fugue had become a flavor that composers would use in order to say, quite literally, look at me, I'm writing a fugue. But, you know, a composer like Handel or Telemann, after, you know, maybe 10 or 20 bars, a fugue would just become like any other piece and basically in a two-part texture. You can see this in Handel's Concerti Grossi, for example, his keyboard works. The fugue is just an idea, and that's that. Bach is really, you know, the figure that sees the fugue all the way through. The counterpoint is always perfect. I think any of us who is in music has taken a course in writing fugue knows that it's easy to start a fugue, but to develop it and to finish it with perfection is very difficult. And I think Bach's remarkable contribution in the art of fugue is, well, firstly, to use different versions of the theme. He inverts it, he augments it, he diminishes it, he adds new themes, sort of counter themes to it. And, you know, it's like an encyclopedia. I really think that a performance of the art of fugue is like opening up the Oxford English Dictionary and reading it out loud.
Let's look ahead to some of the other trailblazing, game-changing works in this season's Proms. What are you looking forward to most?
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to Nixon in China, conducted by the composer himself. And I've listened to this opera many times, but I've actually never had the pleasure of seeing it live. And that's a very exciting prospect. It could not have come sooner to the Proms. I really admire this work, and I'm very much looking forward to it. And tonight's piece, Pelléas and Mélisande, is particularly exciting to me, not only as a lover of Debussy's music, but also, if you like, as a talking head for Baroque music. You know, Debussy was involved in the making of the Rameau edition in the early 20th century, and was very much interested in Rameau's music. And I think there's a lot to be considered about what was the influence of Rameau's composition and Rameau's orchestration, which Debussy and Dandy and many of their contemporaries viewed as a very French style of composition. I think there's to be considered what effect that Rameau had on this piece.
We heard Tom Copeland playing Contrapuntus 4 from Bach's Art of Fugue. And you can hear the piece in its entirety, Mahan Esfahani's new arrangement of this trailblazing work, next Saturday at the Cadogan Hall in London, 3 p.m. It is, like every prom, live here on BBC Radio 3. And a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's celebration of the work of Debussy. John Elliott Gardiner and his Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique launching our celebrations in this Debussy anniversary year with a performance of the composer's only completed opera, Pelléas et Mélisande. Richard Langham-Smith is back with me. Dick, your appraisal of the performance so far and the highlights for you?
Well, frankly, I think it's a revelation. I mean, especially the wind sound. It's not just the instruments, it's the way they're conducted and the way they're played. The phrasing is just so beautiful, and they give a lighter effect. The whole orchestration comes out so much more clearly, and the sounds of the sea, the sounds of the clouds in the sky, everything was just so perfect.
Yeah, those ominous horns, I thought, were magnificent.
The ominous horns were just amazing. And the sound in the sea cave just you hear the sea, but you hear this stormy background as well. Wonderful.
Let's talk a little bit about the orchestral layout as the orchestra drifts back onto stage here at the Royal Albert Hall, because we have this rather unusual layout tonight with the winds mixed up in and among the strings. Why?
Yes, well, John Elliott Gardiner has done that before, actually, with modern instruments, because he takes his cue from a letter, I think it was to Messager, that Debussy wrote, saying...
And Messager
he didn't
is
want
the conductor at the premiere.
Yes. And the idea was that if you just pepper the wind instruments within the strings, you don't get this barrier of strings, and it comes out more like chamber music in a way.
Well, let's hear what John Elliott had to say about exactly that, the impact of this orchestral layout, and why it reflects Debussy's musical vision.
In effect, it's expanded chamber music. It's very, very subtle because it's a series of antiphonies that Debussy sets up across and within the orchestra and between the orchestra and the soloists in a way that really is brand new. Nobody's done it quite that way. And you get these wonderful little kind of antiphonies and dialogues going on. It's like a relay race in some ways, but it's also something where you have to have your antenna up and waving around, and you have to have your radar switched on in order to create this sort of myriad of variegated sounds all the time.
So, and the players must have to listen to each other with a completely different level.
They've got to be super alert. They have to have their radar switched absolutely on, not just to each other, but across the orchestra, across the width of the orchestra. That's what I love about it.
John Elliott Gardiner, he was here at the Proms in the 1980s with Pelléas and Mélisande. He's now back in 2012. Then he was here with Lyon Opera, now here with his period instrument band, the ORR. Do they make a compelling case for you for performing Debussy on the instruments of the composer's own time?
Absolutely. I mean, most often it does. The horns and the trumpets particularly these days can be so heavy. And also what the bassoon sound with the French bassoons is reedier. And the whole sort of ensemble of wind instruments and brass sounds really very, very different and really exciting. It balances so much better.
The highlights for you of Acts 4 and 5, please.
Well, it's the death at the end, really, that you work backwards from, I think.
Which one?
Well, yes, we don't see Pelléas. There was actually a scene that Maeterlinck rejected where Pelléas was found dead at the bottom of a well. But that's excised, like quite a few other scenes. So we
but
just
for you,
go.
It's the death of Mélisande.
It's where we go with Mélisande, and it's to, for me, it's to a happy place.
Richard Langham Smith, a pleasure to talk to you this evening. Enjoy the final two acts. In a few moments, we are indeed back to the action as Golo and Pelléas tussle for the affections of Mélisande. Players of the orchestra settled back on stage with leader Laurent Quenel. And as Dick Langham-Smith was saying, sensational playing from these players. I was talking to principal cellist Robin Michael earlier today, and he was saying that unlike a lot of orchestras, he's found the pleasure of playing with the ORR is that these players want to rehearse more. They don't want to leave at the end of rehearsal and go away and hang out somewhere. They want to keep going and keep going till they get it absolutely right. They work so hard for John Elliott, and he demands hugely high expectations of them, which they absolutely meet tonight. And here is the man himself, Sir John Elliott Gardiner, returning to conduct his orchestra, Monteverdi Choir, and a fine cast of soloists in Debussy's opera, Pelléas in Mélisande.
Ce soir, te verrai-je? Je sors de la chambre de mon père. Il va mieux. Le médecin nous a dit qu'il était sauvé. Il m'a reconnu. Il m'a pris la main et il m'a dit de cet air étrange qui qu'il a depuis qu'il est malade. Est-ce toi, Péance? Tiens, je ne l'avais jamais remarqué, mais tu as le visage grave et amical de ceux qui ne vivront pas longtemps. Il faut voyager, il faut voyager. C'est étrange, je vais lui obéir. Ma mère l'écoutait et pleurait de joie. Ne t'en es pas aperçu, toute la maison semble déjà revivre. On entend respirer, on entend marcher. Écoute, j'entends parler derrière cette porte. Vite, réponds vite, où te verrai-je?
Où veux-tu?
Dans le parc, près de la fontaine des aveugles. Veux-tu, viendras-tu? Ce sera le dernier soir. Je vais voyager comme mon père l'a dit. Tu ne me verras plus.
Ne dis pas cela, Pélias. Je te verrai toujours. Je te regarderai toujours.
Tu auras beau regarder. Je serai si loin que tu ne pourras plus me voir.
Qu'est-il arrivé, Pélias? Je ne comprends plus ce que tu dis.
Va-t'en. Sépare-nous. J'entends parler derrière cette porte.
Quelle foi à la fidélité. God innocence. Mais il ne me Je t'aime. qu'a dit Mélisande? Je ne l'ai presque pas entendu. On a brisé la glace avec des fers rougis. Tu dis cela d'une voix qui vient du bout du monde. Je ne t'ai presque pas entendu. Tu m'aimes aussi. Depuis quand m'aimes-tu?
Depuis toujours.
Yeah! dis donc, tu ne me sembles pas heureuse.
Si, si, je suis heureuse.
Oui, on a fermé les portes.
Nous ne pouvons plus rentrer. Entends-tu les verrous? Écoute, écoute. Les grandes chaînes. Il est trop tard, il est trop tard. Thank you.
Dormir As-tu Avez-vous été coupable Dis Oui, oui, oui. Dis-moi la vérité pour l'amour de Dieu.
Pourquoi n'ai-je pas dit la vérité?
Ne m'en plus ainsi, maman de mourir.
Très faible, je la tiendrai moi-même. Regarde.
Elle ne rit pas, elle est petite. Elle ne va pas rire aussi.
sympathie, que ce que toutes ces femmes viennent faire ici?
Ce sont les servantes.
Qui est-ce qui les a appelées?
Ce n'est pas moi.
Que venez-vous faire ici? Personne ne vous a demandé. Que venez-vous faire ici? Qu'est-ce que c'est donc? Répondez!
Parlez pas trop fort. Elle va dormir. Elle a fermé les yeux.
Elle n'est pas.
Non, non. Voyez, elle respire.
Les yeux sont pleins de larmes. Maintenant, c'est son âme qui pleure. Je n'ai rien vu. Êtes-vous sûr?
This devastating conclusion of Pelléas et Mélisande. Mélisande dead. She's given birth to a child who must take over that terrible legacy of doom and destruction that's plagued this family. The close of Debussy's opera, live performance here at the 2012 Proms in this, the 150th year since Debussy's birth. Sir John Eliot Gardner kicking off the celebrations of Debussy's music that continue across this prom season. Joined here tonight by the orchestra he founded back in 1989, the Orchestre Révolutionnaire et Romantique, led tonight by Laurent Quenelle. The Monteverdi Choir here too tonight in this one-off proms production, a semi-staging of Pelléas. Nahuel Di Piero sang the parts of the Doctor, the Shepherd. Elodie Méchain was Geneviève, the mother of Pelléas and Golo. great singer, the Jordanian soprano, Dima Bawab. She was the young Inyold. She's a member of the Monteverdi Choir. And such a pleasure to be able to wander around backstage over the last couple of days and hear Sir John Tomlinson warming up and rehearsing. He sang the part of Arkell this evening. Leading this live Proms performance tonight, here she is, the Parisian soprano Karen Walsh, Mélisande. She starred in John Elliott Gardiner's 2010 production at the Opéra Comique in Paris. And she was joined there by the other title role Pelléas, Philip Addis, the young Canadian baritone who sang for us here too tonight. A rising star of the opera world. Beautiful performance from him. And finally, we welcome back on stage the jealous murderer, well, ultimately repentant, Golo. Laurent Naoui, incredibly intense presence on stage this evening. John Elliott taking the hands of his cast for a final bow. And that's it from us here at the Royal Albert Hall, Radio 3, the home of the Proms, and what a close to this sensational opening weekend. We will be back here tomorrow, but now it's time to hand you back to BH and Jill Anderson.
Thank you very much. That was Susie Klein at the Royal Albert Hall. And we return to the hall tomorrow evening for our next prom, given by the Juilliard Orchestra from New York and the Orchestra of the Royal Academy of Music in London. John Adams will be conducting them in music by Respighi and his own City Noir. And we'll hear Imogen Cooper playing Ravel's Piano Concerto in G. And that's tomorrow evening at 7:30 here on Radio 3, where we broadcast every prom live. Well, the time now is almost 18 minutes past 10, and time for World Roots with Lucy Duran. Following on from last week's look at the young voices in Malian music today, this week, in another programme recorded in West Africa, she looks back to the late 1950s and 60s, the period of independence and the early days of modern African music.
In October 2011, World Roots visited Bamako, Mali. Whilst we were there, the French Institute, one of the major cultural centres in the city, was hosting a colloquium titled Revisiting the History of Modern African Music, A Return to the Sources. The 1960s and 70s in Mali and neighbouring Guinea after independence witnessed an explosion of musical creativity, especially in the government-sponsored dance bands like Bembea Jazz and Super Biton, whose electric guitars, congas and saxophones did modern interpretations of ancient epic songs from the deep countryside. So to discuss these ideas, on a humid afternoon in Bamako, World Roots convened a round-table discussion of experts in music from across Africa. I was joined by Professor John Collins from the University of Ghana, French record collector and writer Florent Mazzolini, Nigerian-American writer Uchenna Ikone, and Malian journalist Adam Cham. But I started off by asking the authority on the music of Guinea, Graham Council, to explain one of the key moments in the history of post-independence West African music, the period known as cultural authenticity.
Well, authenticity was a cultural philosophy that was, the first president of Guinea, Sékou Touré, was one of its greatest proponents. And if people know about negritude, authenticity can be thought of perhaps the philosophy that followed negritude. But instead of negritude, where negritude sought a kind of a balance with the West, a balance with the Europeans and cooperation with Europeans, authenticity decided to reject the European influence and focus solely on African influences. And so Guinea was the first Francophone country in West Africa to become independent. and the French punished Guinea for that insolence, if you will, by many means. Guinea was left isolated from the economic community, etc., in West Africa. But the first president, Sékou Touré of Guinea, decided he had to do something to reinvigorate the culture of Guinea after a long period of neglect by the French. And so he adopted this cultural philosophy called authenticity, and he directly encouraged musicians and artists to return to the source for inspiration. And so they were directed by the government to go to the, back to their folklore and to modernize that via electric instrumentation. And so the government created a whole range of new orchestras. At one stage, there were over 60 orchestras in Guinea, and all of these orchestras had saxophones, they had trumpets, they had electric guitars, they sometimes, you know, 16 people per band, and the government paid for all of these instruments at enormous expense, and the musicians were told to modernize their folklore. And that created, in a way, a new style of music and a new way of thinking about the past. The reason that he wanted to modernize the music was so that it could hold its head up high and be contemporary with all the other art forms in the world. That was one of the objectives of authenticity. Not so much to return to the past and just present folklore in a kind of
mediated.
Yes, in a kind of modern context, but to present it in a contemporary context.
And it was hugely influential.
It was. It influenced Malian music a lot.
Adam, I know that you love the music of Guinea. Mm.
Yeah,
don't
and
you?
The first two or three guitarists of Mali were trained in Guinea, actually. And I mean, we didn't have a single guitarist in the 60s. I mean, we had three, including Kiletigi, but he was trained in Guinea.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, when the Guinean bands like the Horoya band toured Mali in the mid-60s, late 60s, they told me that the Malians were still playing their folklore, and they hadn't gone to that stage where they were able to adapt it to electric instrumentation, and they explained to them that you can do this, you can modernize your folklore. And Sékou Touré, the president, sent the Guinean bands all throughout Africa and also to the Eastern Bloc countries, and the concept of authenticity got spread right throughout Africa and was adopted in Zaire, etc., and in other countries.
Chenna, can I ask you, because, I mean, you come originally from southeast Nigeria, which is a sort of a place that's very famous for high life bands, great dance bands of the 1960s and 70s. So in Nigeria, was there an awareness of cultural authenticity of the dance bands of Guinea, for example?
I don't think that we ever really had that sort of formal program of authenticity. The idea was that the dance bands did represent modernity as compared to traditional music. And at some point, it was decided to try to Africanize the music a bit more than it had been in the earlier days of high life. But there was never really a complete program that, for authenticity in that way.
It seems like the English-speaking countries like Nigeria and Ghana didn't necessarily know what was going on in the neighboring French-speaking countries. Was there much crossover between...
No, not at all. There was some crossover, perhaps, from Cameroon. There was some influence from Makossa music, for example, and a lot of Cameroonian musicians were very active in Nigeria through the 1970s. So there was that influence. And of course, everybody knows about Franco, so you know we knew some Congo music. But what was going on in Mali, Senegal, most of Francophone Africa, we didn't really have as much knowledge of that at the time. Also, the other thing is that Nigeria is very commercially inclined. The art is often driven by commerce. So the music industry tends not to be driven by those sorts of intellectual imperatives.
John Collins, you are the expert on High Life, and High Life was a seminal popular music in West Africa, and High Life did indeed cross over, didn't it, from the English-speaking countries into French-speaking Africa as well. I mean, was there cultural authenticity in Ghana?
The thing about the difference between Mali or Guinea and Ghana and Nigeria too is that in Ghana you can trace High Life back to the 1880s, height of colonialism. And in fact, if you look at further back you go, the more colonial the music is. In fact, brass bands, they copied the regimental brass bands. And what happened in Ghana without any state intervention was simply that the music was decolonized. And it was decolonized from the 1880s, actually, the first process began. Of course, Nkrumah came in with a sort of a cultural, what did he call it, the African personality, that type of negritude.
Nkrumah
policy.
Being the leader,
Nkrumah,
the
yes,
first, your
yes.
first president.
But he already had a music that had been decolonized prior to the decolonization of the country. And that's why he used High Life straight from the word go.
So have you any idea why that should be the case? Why should... decolonization so early on in a colonial setting?
Because of the difference in the British and the French policy of direct and indirect rule, I think, is one of the reasons. There's a number of reasons, but one is that the British used traditional political mechanisms to rule. Therefore, they allowed a certain type of transculturation, experimentation. You can use different words, hybridization, acculturation. But the French, it was sort of more divided. You were either went the French way or remained the African way. And because I think the British were actually open to using traditional systems politically, it had cultural implications. This is only one explanation, but in a sense, Nkrumah had a ready-made vehicle for national identity, trans-ethnic music, High Life. It was already had a lot of African features.
That's a very significant difference, because when the orchestras at independence in Mali and in Guinea, they weren't playing any Guinean music at all. They were playing French chansons, they were playing European music. They weren't singing in indigenous languages. They weren't playing instruments at concerts for the public, at nightclubs, etc., using traditional instruments at all. So there was this strong rejection of French cultural values. Like the first president of Guinea, he banned French music from the radio.
And also, I think influence was following the migration patterns. I know that when I was a child, I mean, that was more than 50 years ago, I mean, we used to sing Mami Wata, which is a very common song between Guinea, Liberia, Ghana, Nigeria, and Mali. So, I mean, French-speaking countries from this side were really influenced by High Life, but it's the other way around was not true, because you had more Malians in Ghana, in Liberia, than Ghanaian and Liberian in Mali.
High Life was an influence here in Mali, but Malian music was not an influence in Ghana.
No, because, I mean, just because of the migration patterns. I mean, we used to go more in Ghana than Ghanaian coming to Mali.
Yeah, but you would have thought that would mean that Malians living in Ghana would have introduced Malian music.
Yes, except that they were not playing music. Para ti kurulu nara mama di mana. Chofari kurulu nara mama di maye. Para ti kurulu nara mama di mana. Fani gitari fola luna ni mama di barana. Ya bongo se ya ware. Ya bongo se ya ware. Ya bongo se ya ware. Ya bongo se ya ware.
me what
I'm
Does it have to do with the relative development of the recording industries in these countries?
Can I ask Florent Mazzoleni, because you've written several books about African popular music, how do you see this relationship between the Anglophone world and the Francophone world in terms of popular music and tradition and modernity?
I think it's really mixed up because, for instance, as we are just saying, the industry has a lot to do with that. For instance, if we want to have a wide spectrum of African popular music, we better look at Ghana first, and then Congo, and then Guinea. With these three countries, you can tell, you know, how African music will develop. First, it was a hybridization with some European music, as in High Life, and even some kind of African jazz, you know, early stage. Then the Congolese took up on the guitar, which they became master at, you know, look at Franco, look at Dr. Nico, and many, many incredible guitar players in Congo. And then the Guinea took the orchestra side, which was already present in the High Life, and many High Life bands, you know, came to Guinea in the first place, following Nkrumah's pass and first presidential visit to Guinea. But then, if you take the orchestra side, the guitar side, and the dance band, because High Life band in the first place, I think, were really just dance band, and the message wasn't yet so pervading as it was in Sékou Stouré Guinea in the 60s, in the late 50s. I think if you take these three ingredients, you have the history, the evolution of how African music will turn into the following years. And I think if it wasn't for the Congolese, which broadcast their songs through the radio, because radio broadcast broadcasting in French Africa, at least, was really important. You have to look back in 1943 when General de Gaulle came to Brazzaville and set up the first AM radio, you know, across Africa. And this radio could be listened to anywhere else in Africa. And that's how, you know, the Congolese music became to spread in places like Haute Volta or even Mali or the whole place, Nigeria, Ghana, Guinea. All they were listening was
so the media played a very important role. The
media played a part, and the industry part as well, because the Congolese were one of the people from Ghana, I think, were some of the very first country to have their own recording plant and, you know, record label as well. So that's how, you know, the Congolese music started to spread out, followed by the Ghana music, and then, you know, with Silifone and Sékou Touré.
Because Nigeria also was actually the first, as far as I know, the first commercially issued recordings from West Africa were of Nigerian music.
It wouldn't be surprising to me. Nigeria has been pretty much ahead of the curve when it comes to recording. But just like Florent just said, radio is very important. And Congo really had that above everybody else. And that's why their music was able to go all over the continent the way that it did.
The other thing about Nigeria, of course, is that you went into the period of Afrobeat, and that was a whole other story. And, of course, Afrobeat was also hugely influential here in Mali, wasn't it? Well, everywhere,
yes.
All over West Africa.
Oh, yes, we all danced it.
Did you?
Oh,
Adam?
Yes,
really?
Fela Ransom Kuti. And we even transformed the words in Bambara.
If you listen to some rail band song like Dugu Kamelemba, all you listen to is just Fela Ransom Kuti. Yeah.
ma duku kamalemba je bi ima duku kamalemba je yelela ima duku kamalemba je duluna ima duku kamalemba je yalala ima duku kamalemba je kumala ima duku kamalemba je yelela ya e jamo de modo na uma je kula ya e jamo de modo ni masaka so ya e Yala digena joroti ya kamelo morala na kambe tulunga digena joroti.
The success of Afrobeat has a lot to do with the transculturation that Professor Collins talked about, because what Afrobeat really did to some extent was to find a way to re-Africanize soul music, funk music, and also, you know, Latin music. There's a strong, you know, Cuban influence in Afrobeat that is often not talked about. So I think because of that, it was able to spread across the continent and be relatable to Africans from various cultures.
Can I say, when I was young, we used to call it Afro Soul before the word Afrobeat was coined. There's a qualitative difference. I mean, Africans have been copying Black American music now, it's for 211 years, if you go all the way back to Gumbe music from Jamaica. But what's different about soul is the message of soul was Afrocentric, and it predates reggae, of course. And therefore, if James Brown is saying, do your own thing, black and proud, the people who were copying soul music were turned back to their own resources. So if you look at the history of, say, brass band music or swing music as it was transformed into high life, it took Ghanaians, say, about 10 years to transform and imported black American music and indigenize it and incorporate it.
And make it their own.
Yeah, but with soul, it was much quicker, because the message of soul was go back to your own roots. And so there was actually, soul music created a trigger for that particular generation in a big way, actually. Something slightly different from other forms of black American music. I guess you could say the same for reggae now as well.
Graham.
One of the early orchestras that was a trigger for all of the West African orchestras, or for a lot of them, was E.T. Mensa, a Ghanaian group who toured extensively throughout West Africa and inspired musicians throughout that region in the late 1950s and earlier, and led to the inspiration for presidents such as Sékou Touré to have the idea, according to Guinean musicians, to create modern ensembles like E.T. Mensa so that they could modernize their own traditions.
Maybe it's worth mentioning the song Ghana, Guinea, Mali that E.T.
Yes.
Mensa did.
Yeah, yeah, it was one of a number of songs he did sort of supporting Nkrumah's, you know, Pan-African socialist policy. And that one was the brief union, attempted socialist union of the three countries.
So that will have dated from 1957, that song.
A little later, I think it was about 1960 when...
61, 62, because we were forced to learn it at school. I mean, it was supposed to be the antenna of Mali, Ghana, and Guinea. So we tried to learn it for 2 years before it was given up.
You tried to learn that song?
Yeah, Ghana,
Can
Guinea,
Can you remember
Mali.
It at all, Adam?
Yes. But I've now forgotten, and we didn't like it, actually, because...
you didn't like it because?
No, you know, people from my generation used to like, for instance, Fela Ransom Kuti, but people from the generation of my mother would prefer King Sony Ade, for instance, because of the tama and all the
talking
tama.
Drum.
So we didn't think that Guinea, Ghana, Mali was the usual... type of song coming from Ghana and Nigeria, which we're used to.
Ghana, Guinea, Mali Union has laid down a strong foundation for redemption of Africa, for which we've been strongly fighting.
Ghana, Guinea, Mali,
the nucleus of the great union.
Ghana, Guinea, Mali,
Africa's strongest foundation.
Ghana, Guinea, Mali,
the nucleus of the great union.
Ghana, Guinea, Mali,
has now once been laid forever,
First it was Ghana and Guinea, later Ghana, Guinea, Mali. Soon it will be all Africa, the achievement of our greatest day.
Ghana, Guinea, Mali.
The nucleus of the great union.
Ghana, Guinea,